Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm John McCoy, your host, and with me again is our, what, three times returning champion?
I'm not sure anymore, but everyone who is a member of the Sophomore Lit Facebook group should know that I'm a page administrator, so no bad comments about this episode are allowed.
It's Shannon Camp, back to talk more about young adult books this time. As you recall, last year sometime, we did the Robert Cormier, A Chocolate War. And at the time, I apologized to Shannon for having to read such a boy book. And so this time, we're doing a girl book.
Revenge is a dish best served cold.
We're doing Judy Blume's Forever. And Judy Blume was one of those writers that I remember sometime around middle school, every girl in school had a copy of one or other of Judy Blume's books hidden away in their backpack, and they would pass them around. And I always kind of wondered what that was about. So I guess now I get to find out.
Yeah, I guess I get to find out too, because my experience with Judy Blume was very much with her middle grade reader books, I guess is what they're called now. Specifically the Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing series starring Peter Hatch and his mischievous yet precocious little brother Fudge, and of course the know-it-all girl who obviously has a crush on him but hides it poorly, Sheila Tubman, who had her own book, Sheila the Great. So when you asked me to do a Judy Blume book, those were all the stories that came into my mind, and they're very, very much pitched towards 9, 10, and 11-year-olds. You suggested I try to pick something for slightly older readers, and I had really never read any of her teen girl books. I had maybe read parts of Forever because I knew something about the plot going in that was what made me want to pick it for this episode. But this was basically my first read of her teen material.
So you never read Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
You know, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret is such a famous title. Like, even people who have never read the book think they have an idea of it based on the title. I think by the time I was a girl in the early 2000s, the idea of reading Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret was too embarrassing. Like, everyone knew that book was about periods. If I had carried that book around in school, I would have been relentlessly teased. I mean, that was the sort of book you hid under your mattress. And if I had had Forever, I would have definitely hidden it under my mattress.
Forever is Blume's big teen sex novel. It comes from a time in the mid-70s when there were lots of books out there for kids on the topic of sex. I think that after the sexual revolution of the 60s, a lot of that was percolating out into the popular culture, and people were a lot more frank and forward about this stuff back in the day. This is the time before the Reagan administration. It's kind of startling in some ways to read this book now, although, from what I gather, young adult novels have again turned the corner into being pretty steamy, what with your Twilights and your other Twilights.
I thought Forever was actually very different from the books that I read when I was a teen girl that did inform my view of sex, which I did really get from books and from fan fiction on the internet. I'll just say it, because my parents really didn't allow me to watch TV or movies very much. So I did get most of my information about sex from books. But you talked about steamy teen books. They were as much of a problem as the prudish ones, because those books make it seem like your first sexual encounter is going to be like this magical, passionate, you know, sexually satisfying experience. Or a lot of books for young women pitch either your first time or sex in general as something very traumatic. I mean, even when you're hitting teen novels, you're already finding a lot of books whose plots hinge on rape or sexual assault. So Forever actually, for me, kind of scratched that sweet spot where the sex wasn't like lovemaking, like we are expert lovers, your body is like a finely tuned instrument that I shall play upon. But it wasn't a traumatic experience either. Like it kind of accurately depicted how sex is both a big deal and not a big deal.
That's what I find quite charming about the book, and we'll get into that when we talk more about it. I think if there's anything about this book that if you could encapsulate this book in one word, it's demystifying. It's really, I think that's Bloom's whole point about this, is to try and lay a reassuring hand on your shoulder and say, look, it's going to be okay. It's not going to be great. It's not going to be terrible. It's going to be okay.
Yeah, mission accomplished, Aunt Judy. I thought this book was cool. Like, if I were reading it as a teen girl, I would have been like, this is so dorky. But now, as someone who is, like, a caregiver to a preteen, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, she really just cuts to the heart of the issue in such a respectful way. Like, I was so into it. I have to admit, I, like, really respected what she was trying, even at the times when it didn't fully succeed to, like, work in a way that felt natural. Even when you could see her pulling the strings, I really, like, I don't know, like, I just had an incredible surge of goodwill towards Judy Blume while reading this book.
Let me give a brief recap for anyone who hasn't read the book, although as we were talking about this before we started recording, we both agreed that this is kind of a plot light book. It's a lot more about scenes of dialogue and scenes that I think are supposed to be exemplary of how you might approach your first sexual encounter, your first trip to Planned Parenthood.
Oh, I'm gonna love watching you talk about all of this. I can feel the discomfort from all the way from Boston to Chicago already.
Okay, well, with that in mind, this book takes place in 1975. It's a time, as I mentioned, before the Reagan administration, when there was a magical land of suburban New England. And it's a land in which the parents don't really care if their teenage kids are having sex, just so long as they're careful and read all the pamphlets ahead of time. It's about the main character, who is high school senior Catherine Danziger. She's 17 going on 18, and she meets the love of her life up to this point, Michael Wagner, at a New Year's party, and they fall in lust almost immediately. Catherine has a friend named Erica Small, who is small, and she thinks that Catherine and Michael should just go ahead and do it already, but Catherine is determined to take things slow. Erica, by the way, has trouble raising the sexual interest of her boyfriend, Artie, who is strongly hinted to be gay by virtue of the fact that he's a good actor.
It's literally true. John is not trying to be funny. This is just the facts. This is just the facts. We'll get into it, because, you know, as a high school theater kid, I have a lot of stuff to say about that whole plot line.
Catherine and Michael have a series of dates, and they even have a skiing trip where Michael's sister Sharon shows up and warns Catherine not to mess with her little brother's heart. Everyone around the couple seems interested in their sex lives, including Catherine's parents, who leave articles about sex lying around the place, her grandma, who seems to be getting a vicarious thrill from the whole situation, her little sister Jamie, who claims to know all about sex. Apparently everybody in town has a stake in whether or not these two guys get together. Eventually, the two do the deed in Michael's sister's apartment. And Catherine is unsatisfied with the initial experience, but nonetheless, she goes on to visit Planned Parenthood and gets on the pill, and Michael buys Catherine a necklace that has their names on it and says, forever. From this point in the book, the word forever appears maybe twice on the page, every page. However, forces are conspiring against the two. Catherine and Michael are headed to different colleges in different states, and their summer jobs as well send them in different directions. Erica, at this point, still untouched by Artie, breaks things off with him, and he attempts suicide and is institutionalized. There's also a friend named Sybil, who hasn't really done much up till this point, but now it turns out that she's gotten herself pregnant, and she brings the baby to term and puts it up for adoption. That storyline also doesn't seem to go much of anywhere. At her summer camp job, Catherine's supervisor is a college man, Theo, who calls her Cat and who poo-poos her forever necklace. So, of course, he's irresistible to her, and the two eventually kiss after she's very sad about her grandpa dying. Catherine breaks the news of the kiss to Michael, and he takes it hard and breaks things off with her. But that's okay, because Catherine was really not ready for forever. So that's the plot, such as there is for Forever. I would say this book kind of falls into a category of books that I was really not fond of when I was young, which is the genre of problem books. It seemed to me like when I was about a teenager, there were all these books out there that were to help you, if you're a teenager, get through the death of a relative, or to help you get through, you know, if your parents divorce, or if you're going through bullying at school or something like that. And I kind of pegged this book more as a kind of a problem book for girls. Like, it was going to like be very exemplary of a certain time in your life. I mean, reading it through, I found it to be, yes, that, but also, I think, a bit of lovely bit of writing. What did you think?
Well, I'm sort of two minds, because at first I was extremely jarred. I was like, this is not as funny or as interesting as the Peter Hatch series, which has a lot more like detail in the descriptions of the world. It's not just like dialogue scenes of people talking to each other, and the characters feel more fully realized. So that was a hard first impression to overcome. But then as I allowed myself to, you know, let go of all my super fudge feelings and get more into the book, I started to really appreciate Forever, because even though I grew up quite a bit after the book was written and published, I really think probably to this day to some extent, although I was this age before social media had really taken hold the way that it has, and I know that that has really affected the lives of teenagers and teenage girls and teen dating, but I thought there were a lot of things about this book that would be a problem in another book, but in this context, I liked it. Like, the whole Sybil story, so there's this girl named Sybil who Catherine doesn't know very well. Like, she's Erica's cousin. She goes to a different school. They're acquainted, but they're not friends. And she ends up, you know, getting pregnant and then choosing to conceal it long enough that she can carry it to term so she can have the experience of having a baby. I feel like in 2016, if the book had been written, it would have been written about Sybil. But as a girl growing up in a normal suburban town, I felt like I was Catherine, and I would hear these Sybil stories. You know, you'd hear about a girl who went to the high school two towns over, or maybe she went to the private Catholic school across the street, and, you know, this scandalous thing had happened. And it was the sort of thing you heard about, but it never happened to you. You know, does that make any sense? Like,
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I felt like the Sybil story was there to illustrate yet another wrinkle on sexuality. Catherine, when she decides to go all in with Michael, then we get this checklist of things that seem kind of like what you might expect to be discussed when you're dealing with sexuality. There's stories about venereal disease, there's stories about, in this case, pregnancy. And the remarkable thing is none of these are held up as, oh, see, you shouldn't be doing this. They're more like, okay, here's something you need to know. If I had any problem with Sybil, it seemed too much to me like it was convenient to be an educational moment for Catherine than it being her own story.
Yeah, I didn't enjoy the scene where they visited her in the hospital because it definitely felt that way. I'm just saying, I think most of the girls in the world are Catherine's, and, you know, like, it, that was a part of the story that felt realistic to me, not in that Sybil's actual experience was something that happens very frequently, but that it was the sort of thing that it doesn't happen to anyone you know that well, but you heard of a friend's cousin's friend's sister who it happened to. And another thing you mentioned in talking about the summary was feeling like in this book, all the characters are kind of obsessed with sex in a way and like really interested in it. From the time I was like 13, which is Jamie, Kath's younger sister's age, to the time I was probably after 18, after the age Kat is, I definitely felt like the whole world and my parents and my grandparents and everyone were obsessed with sex, because it's the age when you first start noticing that like it's everywhere. It's in the advertising and adults are dropping little winks to it in conversation, and you start to kind of comprehend that like, oh, like Kath does, my parents are doing it and everything. So I think I did feel like the world was obsessed with sex. There was a musical that came out when I was 14, and I just lived and died by it, called Spring Awakening. It came out my freshman year of high school. And there's an exchange that the two boys, who are each 14 years old, have in the show where Melchior says, "It seems like the whole world is obsessed with sex." And his friend Moritz replies, "Well, I know I am." And that line definitely came into my head when I was reading this book.
I think it is true that sex permeates everything in adulthood. What I thought was funny about this was it seemed to me like all the peripheral characters were intensely interested in Catherine and Michael's relationship in a way that seemed kind of strange to me. I think that when you're a teenager, you're very self-centered. And certainly when you're a teenager who's first discovering sex, you are convinced that you have greater insight into the whole thing than anyone has ever had. But it seems like everyone around them was confirming the level of importance that these two people were placing upon their relationship. Catherine's parents got involved. Catherine's grandparents got involved. Catherine's sister. Didn't they have sex of their own to deal with? I don't.
I mean, I definitely think at times her parents played into her hands by showing too much concern. I thought it was really funny, the like attitude of, well, you're just going to date one boy. You're not going to like date around, because I feel like the modern high school or parent of a high schooler just wants their kid to find like one kid who they can live with, who seems safe, and just date them for a bit, as opposed to having like five boyfriends at once or have like a rotating door of, you know, people sauntering in and out. The school week dragged on. Jamie said I looked like a sick dog. Well, that's how I felt. At dinner one night, my father asked me if I'm going steady with Michael. "We don't call it going steady," I told him, "but we are going together."
"Does that mean you can't see anyone else?" he asked.
"That means I don't want to see anyone else." "I went steady once," Mom said, stirring a teaspoon of honey into her tea. "And I wore a school ring on a chain around my neck. His name was Seymour Mandelbaum."
"Seymour Mandelbaum," Jamie said and cracked up.
"I was a junior and he was a senior," Mom told us. "I wonder whatever happened to him." I got the feeling that Mom was talking about her old boyfriend so my father would see that it didn't matter about Michael and me going together. Then Dad surprised me by saying, "I went steady twice."
"You?" I asked. "Once when I was in 10th grade," I gave her my ID bracelet, "and once when I was a freshman in college."
He and Mom started reminiscing about their college days. "I didn't tell them that with Michael and me, it's different. That it's not just some 50s fad like going steady. That with us, it is love. Real, true, honest to God, love."
This is something that came up when I was discussing 15 with Phil over on the Clickacast podcast. Back in the 50s, I think there was much more of an emphasis upon people dating around. There was, it was kind of frowned upon if you had a steady. That was considered a bad thing by older people. And my mom has told me this quite frequently, that when she was a teenager, her parents encouraged her not to settle down with one boyfriend. Now, they were also not encouraging her to have sex.
Yeah.
And ostensibly, nobody was having sex in those days. I think this is kind of on the cusp of something here in the 70s. I'm just amazed by the casualness with which everybody deals with the subject, or at least the way that nobody wants to make a moral issue out of anything in the book. They only are concerned about the health of the children and that their both their physical health and their emotional, mental well-being through this. There's no talk about the morality of sex outside of marriage.
I liked that. I liked that it wasn't like, God is watching you hump on your sister's bathroom rug. But, it was clear to me that her parents didn't want her to have sex. They didn't forbid it because they seemed to feel that they couldn't forbid it, but they, I didn't feel that they were encouraging. Like, her mom implies that not only would she have waited, but that she only had sex with Catherine's dad before marriage because they were engaged, which was exactly the same line I got from my mother. So that there were a couple moments in the book that I felt were very on the nose.
The other thing that I found interesting reading this was the way that it reminded me of so many other books that I read back in the 80s that had been written in the 70s. There's a lot of funny little ticks that this book has. There's a ton of pages go by that are just dialogue without any description, and the dialogue is extremely clipped and halting. There are so many ellipses in this book, including in the title, there's an ellipses. So it's kind of like, I don't know, it's like the original mumblecore or something here. But the other thing that I sort of got on my nerves too was the fact that nobody was really that clever or smart or remarkable in this book.
John, how dare you? Her little sister Jamie can cook. Does that mean nothing to you? No.
Yes, that's true.
That's exactly what I was talking about when I was comparing this to the Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing series, which has like a bunch of super iconic characters, like between Fudge and Sheila, and like everyone has a big personality. And when they're talking, you know that like they're saying words that none of the other characters would put together in that order. Whereas with this book, Michael, who is basically the secondary lead, his primary trait is horniness. And if I had to come up with another personality trait for him, I would not be able to. So I gotta say, there were moments of reading the book that I felt like visceral discomfort, just because no specific moment lined up with a specific moment in my life, but it just reminded me of what dealing with teenage boys was like. And I have repressed those memories so hard. I did not need them to come floating back to the surface.
Poor Michael does not really have much going on for him, other than, I guess, he's there. I will be the first to admit that I'm a straight male and my teen years are long behind me, but I just did not see the attraction, other than I guess it was Catherine's time. I think she was ready herself.
The boy sitting on the other side of her was a creep, and Michael was sitting on the other side of her and he was fine. That's exactly how it went down. And I don't feel like Judy Blume really tries to disguise the fact that Michael isn't that hot. Their breakup is extremely non-traumatic and almost non-emotional in some ways. But honestly, like, I feel like that's how it goes. Like, it's very dramatic and then it's not. Like, you know, these things really do just sort of fizzle to a close. It's not like Catherine and Michael have to divide up their positions and see who gets custody of, you know, the kids on weekends.
Yeah, I really liked the way that this book handled their eventual breakup. There could have been either the parents or even a narrative voice that came in and said, look, these kids thought they had this great romance for the ages, but they're just dumb kids and, you know, just took one summer apart to break them up. But it didn't. And part of what happened was she met a guy who was a little more clever. I mean, Theo is not that great either.
Theo has a mustache, sir. Does that mean nothing to you?
Well, Theo's a college boy, so he's he has a mustache and he has a nickname for Catherine. So those things make him just a delight. I do like the way that they break things off and Michael tries to make, I think, something of a scene of it, but it kind of feels like his heart isn't really in it either.
Yeah, he says, like, because Kath, very, in what seems to be like an earnest show of like, I just have to be honest, she tells him that she and Theo kissed, which they did after she found out that her grandpa died, which was the time in my life I felt the least like kissing anybody, to be totally honest. Anyway, he's like, I humped everything in North Carolina. That's basically exactly what he says. He says humped. I had like sex with everything that moved. And Kath goes, no, you didn't. You're just trying to hurt me. But she doesn't really seem to care. And he goes, well, you'll never know. And that's basically the last conversation they have.
You know, the other thing that was kind of funny about this book was it was very slow moving for the first, I don't know, three quarters of the book. And then suddenly, almost all the plot that happens in this book happens in the last 20 pages, including poor, what's his
Artie.
Name?
Okay.
Artie.
You end chapter 17 with the kids having their, like, uncomfortable night at Erica's house where, like, it's kind of supposed to be, like, a two couples hanging out thing, but the couples are at very different places in their relationships. Turn the page, top of chapter 18, Artie hanged himself that night from the shower rod, but it fell down, so he was okay. And I literally gasped out loud, like, I never, because, yeah, it was I was blindsided by it. I guess the signs were sort of there, and maybe that's sort of the point, is that an acquaintance, a friendly acquaintance, like, Cat wouldn't really realize when a fellow teenager is showing the signs of being suicidal, but I still found it to be quite abrupt.
Yeah, I found it abrupt, and it left a kind of a bad taste in my mouth a few ways. I felt like the way in which he hung himself and then the shower rod broke was almost played for humor.
Yeah.
And the fact that all through this book, they've been hinting that Artie is gay, but it's 1975, and either Bloom is not allowed to, or she just doesn't have it in her to actually go there and investigate what the implications of that are for a teenager living in the mid-70s. That's forever black boxed, and Artie gets to be, you know, that most cliched of characters, the gay suicide.
Yeah. And his suicide attempt doesn't really affect Kat at all. I mean, she seems more concerned with how it affects Erica and Michael, which sort of honestly makes sense because she wasn't really friends with Artie. Erica and Michael were. But it still comes off as, like, almost bizarrely cold at times.
Well, she was very affected by his performance in that play.
As that blind boy trying to make it on his own. The summary of the play is a blind boy trying to make it on his own. Oh.
The thing that made me laugh out loud was when she tells him what a great actor he is. It's because he made it seem like he was really blind.
Yeah, it's really cute, though. It's like the earnest, you know, kids are like that. I remember when my school put on West Side Story, I was the assistant stage manager and understudy for Anybody's. And the boy who played Ice, who sings Cool, was also the captain of the football team. And it was like a big High School Musical, the movie type thing. Like all the football players came to see the musical, which was very unheard of. And the next day in class, one of the football players who sort of knew me and knew that I was working on the show apparently very earnestly asked me where we found all those Puerto Rican kids. So
now yeah, you grew up in suburban Chicago, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I basically grew up in Shermer, Illinois. Like, if anyone needs to picture what my life was like, the Illinois of the John Hughes movies is exactly it. Exactly. Sometimes right down to the locations. And the mall from Mean Girls is actually the same mall that my friends and I went to in high school. So, yep, that's suburban Chicago for you. And actually, I was more of an Erica than a Catherine, although I was not trying to have sex with him. I did go to prom with a friend who was not openly gay, but I had strong reason to believe might be. And a couple of times he sort of tried to like put it out there like he was going to be romantic with me, but like neither of our hearts were in it and just nothing happened. But I never felt disappointed because I never had any expectations. I kind of like knew the score from the beginning. But I wanted to mention, while we're on the topic of Artie's plot and how it kind of left us with a bad taste in our mouth in some ways, even though I thought the way the Sybil plot was included was basically realistic, because I felt I have a ton of anecdotes from my teenage years where like, yeah, this didn't happen to anyone I know, but it's the friend of a friend. But at the same time, all that stuff about Sybil being overweight, which is written out for either like laughter or you're supposed to be like, oh, she's fat, but she still has a lot of sex. What's the deal with that? Like, everything about that made me profoundly uncomfortable, and I can't imagine a book nowadays writing about an overweight teenager that way. I really, really, really didn't like that.
The book is, I think, as progressive as a book could be in 1975, but it's very much a product of the 70s, if only because there are scenes where they describe shag rugs and the like. The one thing I will say about Sybil and Erica, the thing that I did like about this book was it took it kind of matter-of-factly that these teen girls had strong sexual feelings and that they were pretty much just, you know, boiled down to being kind of horny. No one passed judgment on them for that. Certainly not the author, not the other characters. Catherine, of course, is trying to figure out, part of what the book is about is her trying to figure out what exactly the sexual act means to her. I think in the end, one of the things it says is like, you know, be careful simply because you don't know what it's going to mean to you. And maybe, you know, you'll turn out to be this important emotional experience, or it may just turn out to be sex, whatever, you know, just take it slow and be careful and have fun, kids. Is kind of the attitude of the book.
If I had picked up this book as a young teenager, I would have been totally stunned by the scene where her grandmother gives her all the lowdown on Planned Parenthood, because until hitting college, I thought Planned Parenthood was an abortion clinic, you know? Like,
right.
Nothing else. So, my grandparents definitely would have never been the ones to give me that info. My parents didn't ever really have like sex talks with me, but that's because I was the girl going to prom with the gay kid. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't have to give me a sex talk because they knew there was nothing to worry about.
Well, maybe they were behind the scenes saying, you know who I think you should go to prom with? Is that nice? That nice young gentleman.
Oh, they loved him. Who wouldn't? Come on. That's every parent's dream.
You mentioned reading this book now and feeling some level of solidarity with Judy Blume's message and appreciating it. I find it remarkable that this book survives. I thought that when we were reading this, that we were going to be reading something that was kind of a time capsule. But while I was doing research on this, I was finding essays written online about people who loved the book now, or who were now, you know, 30 years after it's been published, were remembering being teenagers and giving it to their teenage daughters. I'm kind of fascinated to think of this book as a book that continues, because it seems to me like in some ways it's been supplanted by other books, but in other ways I guess there's nothing quite like it, in that it's a book that really does kind of check off a lot of these boxes about what the teen girl experience is when it comes to things having to do with sex.
Yeah, I think sometimes maybe this is just my perspective as a young woman, and I'm not that far out of my teen years because I'm 24. I think maybe sometimes people don't remember that to this day there still is a lot of shame surrounding female sexuality, and young girls have a lot of different complexes. A lot of sexual experiences are still, you know, shown as something that, even if it is consensual, is very painful and traumatic, and it changes your life forever. Oh, forever, dot, dot, dot. And I like that Judy Blume doesn't cast her moral judgment on the characters. It's not even any particular thing about the book itself besides her earnestness that is winning me over, I think. And part of it is that this book caught me at a good time. Like, I am in a different place in my life than I was last February when I appeared on Sophomore Lit's Valentine's themed episode. I'll just put it out there. So, like, I was already in a more charitable mood towards love stories than I might usually be. But yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking of something your brother Dan said, actually, ages ago on the Flophouse when he was recommending the movie Easy A, about how he liked that it was one of the few teen movies that didn't present sex as like something that was nothing at all, like everyone's just having it, it doesn't mean anything, and it also wasn't shown as something that like is the most earth-shatteringly romantically significant, like you found your soulmate thing. And for me, Forever kind of scratches that same itch.
Yeah, and the other thing that I think it does really, really well is in a very compact space, it does really show the way in which getting good at sex takes practice. One of the things that kind of surprised me by the end of this relationship, Catherine was much more self-assured, much more in control of the sexual encounters, and much more actively seeking out what she wanted from those things.
Sure. I still don't believe that her teenage boyfriend was giving her multiple orgasms from penetration alone, which happened in the book. She has one sexual encounter with him where she's on top and they're having penetrative penis and vagina sex, or I should say Ralph and vagina, because we haven't even touched that one yet, which is the whole reason I made you read this book. Anyway, she orgasms twice, once as he himself is coming. And I was like, no, no, you're 18 years old. You're not orgasming at the same time. Take it from a 24-year-old who knows.
We might as well mention here, as Shannon mentions, that Michael did name his penis Ralph. I know one other teenage boy that I was friends with who gave his penis a name. And the fact that I know that is one of the reasons why I really, really disliked this kid when I was growing up, because
why Michael is just the horny guy of this book. But I have a couple of things to say about this. One, I understand why Judy Blume did it. This is my theory. This is something I came up with totally by myself, because I was like, it's weird that they keep calling it Ralph after the initial jokey scene where she gives him a handjob. It's weird that every time they have sex, now they're having like full-on real sex, they're still calling it Ralph. I almost started to wonder, you know, as interested as teenage girls are in sex and having sex, they're not particularly enamored with penises themselves. In my experience, because penises are kind of alien and ugly. No offense to anyone who might be listening to this podcast. I'm not talking about any penis specifically. And, you know, they're kind of the scariest part of the whole sex thing. Like, it's not the nakedness or the, I mean, that's a part of it. The nakedness, the emotional intimacy, all of that. But I almost wondered if Judy Blume had Michael name the penis Ralph and then continue to call it Ralph in the narration to kind of, if you'll forgive the pun, soften things a little bit. So I actually would have rather that she had disposed of that, though, because if she wants to have this book be like a frank talk about sex, then she should be using the biological words for things. But maybe I'm getting overly personal here. You can cut this if need be. Did it strike you as weird that they went straight to from hand jobs to sex without doing blowjobs in between?
You know, I can't speak from experience, but my thought is, back in the 70s, they were not a common sex act. They were popularized through pornography, and they were kind of seen as outré by suburban practitioners of sex who tended to stick to the straight missionary stuff. But I'm not a sexologist. This is all secondhand from reading disreputable histories.
I'm not a sexologist either, but I can tell you that those attitudes have changed. I think if this book were written now, that would have been a part of the story. I think that because of like the bases idea that kids have, like this is first base, this is second base, this is third, etc. I don't know. When I was talking about it with friends and stuff growing up, because even though I wasn't having sex in high school, I had plenty of friends who were, and I didn't, you know, necessarily judge it, although I was terrified of it. And I do think that now it's kind of seen as like oral sex is the gateway drug to real sex.
You know, why don't you email Judy Blume and maybe you guys can do a reboot of, you know, a gritty reboot of Forever for the millennial age.
No, I don't want it to be gritty. I liked how sweet. I mean, the thing is, if I emailed Judy Blume, I'd have a better chance of getting an email back than emailing almost any other author, because she is the sweetest lady in the world and her Twitter is adorable. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I feel like the good intentions of this book were so apparent that it overwhelmed all the things that gave me pause, such as Michael's family's reaction to their relationship, not just his sister warning Catherine about breaking his heart, but his mother being like very, very cold and bitchy to her. And like all the stuff, even though you pointed out that Kath's family, no one really has a strong personality, they are all like at the top of their game. Like her, our house is whatever. I guess it's kind of cool that we have paintings and embroidered tapestries and giant plants everywhere, and our furniture is beige, so it blends into the decor. But like, I don't even notice it anymore. It's not a big deal. And yeah, my 13-year-old sister is basically like a child prodigy, but whatever. She may spend all day making veal marsala. It's not even a big deal. And yeah, my mom got a bikini for her 40th birthday. And yeah, my dad's super hot and my babysitter's all totally wanted to bang him, but we're just like an ordinary family of normal people who are completely unglamorous. Oh, my grandmother, yeah, she does have a big important job in New York City, and whenever we go to restaurants, the chefs know her and my grandpa, but we're just like anyone else.
You know, you bring up a good point here, because I had completely forgotten that bit at the beginning about Catherine's dad being so hot that the babysitter runs to his closet and sniffs all his clothes.
Never a problem that was going to happen with my babysitters. No offense, Dad.
It's sort of like this weird perfect life that Catherine is living. It's certainly a perfect suburban life. I kind of wonder, you know, in the same way that it may be that the reason that sex permeates everything around Catherine is she's reaching that point in her life where it's becoming her preoccupation, so she's seeing it everywhere. And similarly, as she's becoming a young woman and she has her own vision of what she wants to be as a success in life, she's projecting that out into the world and seeing things as much more glamorous than they really are.
Oh, yeah. Think about how enamored she is with Michael's sister's apartment. The decor in the master bedroom is a poster of a chimpanzee. Glamorous.
Well, he has a brass bed. He has a brass bed, and that's the most important thing, because that gets...
That gives you something to hold on to.
Presented on the front cover of the original edition. It's the brass bed that they first did it on.
Ow!
Okay, so I think we've covered about everything in this book. Any suggestions of where people might go from here if they want more Judy Blume or if they want more Teen Awakening
books?
Sure.
Wow, Teen Awakening, kind of my area of expertise, is it not? I'm a perma-teen, very much an evergreen teen, and I can prove it because I was at a hotel for a friend's father's funeral last weekend, and there was also a high school cheerleader convention at the hotel, and when I got into the elevator, a teenage boy asked me, "Hey, where can I get one of those cheer shirts y'all are wearing?" And I was like, looking at him like, "Please stop making eye contact with me, this is unacceptable!" Anyway. My final thoughts on Forever, I would say, you know, it's one thing to read this book as an adult, but I think I would have had a different experience as a teenage girl. I think it's easy to lose sight of the fact that our society still really makes teen girls ashamed of and afraid of sex, and books like this are really, really important. There was a book that I actually did read in high school, unlike this, or maybe even junior high. I don't remember the book. I don't remember what it was about. I don't remember any of the characters' names. But I do remember a scene between two of the teenage girls in the bathroom. One of the girls' mother was having a baby, and she was really scared that her mom was going to die. And the other girl showed her in the mirror how, like, your mouth is pretty small when you're just holding it normally and you're talking through it. But you can, like, stretch your mouth really, really, really big, and you're still okay, and it doesn't hurt. And that was kind of the explanation of, like, how the baby was going to come out. And I know that's not a perfect explanation, but as a teenage girl who was terrified of, you know, everything about my own body and everyone else's, I got a lot of comfort out of that scene that kind of talked about how the female body is stronger than you would think. And so I think books like this are important. Unfortunately, I can't remember that book or, like I said, anything else about it besides that scene where they talk about, like, cervical openings. But I did read a book that I really liked this past year called The Fever by Megan Abbott. And it's from the perspective of a few different teenage girls and some parents and one of their teenage brothers. I almost don't want to say too much about it because it's a little bit more of a mystery slash thriller than your standard teen fare, but it very much takes on the issue of how people are terrified of teen girls' sexuality. It's called The Fever. It's about a group of high school girls who kind of start dropping like flies one by one when they start exhibiting symptoms of a mysterious illness, and the town's kind of desperation to figure out what could be causing this terrible illness. And it's all tied into the teenage girl's sex and sexuality.
I just want to give a little bit of advice to all the teen boys out there. Go ahead and read some Judy Blume or anything else written for girls. When I was a kid, this was a wall you did not cross. This was a line in the sand. You just stayed away from that stuff. And that's just stupid.
And it's not fair because, I mean, I was over there reading all of Peter Hatch's stories. You know, girls don't stop reading boys' stories. Boys just stop reading girls' stories. Teen boys, be better. Maybe when you see a woman in an elevator, she's not a teen cheerleader. Maybe she's an adult there for a funeral, okay? Buck up. Wise up. Open those eyes. Not everything is there for you to hump.
Thanks again to co-host Shannon Camp. Her podcast, Stage of Fools, is available on iTunes and everywhere else you can find podcasts. Hey guys, this is the time of the year when we remind you about how you can support this podcast by becoming a member of The Incomparable. You can sign up for a monthly or annual pledge to support this podcast directly. Here's what to do. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up. You'll be asked to pick the shows on the network you'd like to support. If you just check the box for Sophomore Lit, your entire contribution will come to us after a few fees are taken out. If you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, you can also check their boxes, and your contribution will be shared equally by all the shows you want to support. As a thank you for supporting us, members receive extras, including exclusive bonus audio, a live bootleg feed of The Incomparable, and a members-only Slack group. Since this is pledge season, this month, many of the shows on the network will be posting bonus episodes just for members. In this case of Sophomore Lit, you'll get to hear the backdoor pilot for Landfill Literature, a podcast I may or may not someday do about bad bestsellers. We'll be covering Jonathan Livingston Seagull. There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 per month, and annual equivalents are available as well. And if you're already a member, it's easy to increase your pledge to a higher level and get some special goodies in return. So if you'd like to support us, go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up. And thanks. As always, you can join us on the Facebook page or write to me directly at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. And remember, everything will be on the final.